Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Nice to be back in London town after our trip to Chorley last week. A busy old week ahead too. Coming up on the podcast this week, we'll obviously bring you PMQs Unpacked. We've also got an exclusive interview with Michael Cockerell about his new memoirs, the legendary documentary maker. And we'll take a look at how things can go wrong at party conferences. All that's coming up on the podcast this week. Today, read all about it. Political magazines are booming. Even print sales. Print is not dead, it seems. We'll speak to the editors of The Spectator and The New Statesman to find out why people are flocking back to print, but also their relationships with the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, respectively. So that's coming up in our big thing in a moment. But first, our columnist panel today with Libby Purvis from The Times and Rachel Cunliffe from The New Statesman. Libby, let's start with this story about gas. And it all seems a bit complicated, and who, depending on whose fault we think it is, depends, you know, we'll decide what we think should be done about it. But talk of the government considering emergency state-backed loans to energy companies to sort of bail them out. It's all a bit reminiscent, Libby, of when they, you know, stepped in to buy up the bad banks.
It always seems like a rather mad system to me that there should be so many companies all buying the same stuff and then charging slightly different prices for it. But what's really interesting, and nobody is talking about, and I get, you know, the science people are not talking about it yet in the papers, is the technology in the energy story. Because one moment we're all told that carbon dioxide, terrible stuff, CO2, too much of it, people have to glue themselves to motorways to persuade us to use less. And the next thing is, no, it's absolutely vital, we can't do without it, it's all disastrous, we need more carbon dioxide. So I looked up this thing, and there is a thing called direct air capture. It's a new process, which is sort of very expensive so far, but could get better, which is actually direct air capture. You take the unwanted carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and use it for the things you actually need to use it for. And it just struck me that since we were talking about the same thing in two completely different contexts, I want a bit more, you know, I want the science people to get their noses down into this one, because I haven't read anything about it in the normal press at all.
Yeah, you're right. Generally, carbon dioxide does get a bad press, it's fair to say. But yeah, I was reading today, so it's used to stun animals for slaughter and in the food packaging business, and then it's used as dry ice, which supermarkets use for chilled food deliveries. And so supermarkets are now scrabbling to try and get hold of carbon dioxide. Because so this the high gas prices could have a knock-on effect of less frozen stuff in the shops.
But meanwhile, we're told we're emitting too much of it.
Yeah.
Therefore, we need to find a way to join the two together, direct air capture. Switzerland and Canada are starting on this one. There are two companies doing it, I think.
Yeah, and there's big concerns about what this is going to mean for turkeys. Rachel, are you concerned about the fact that, well, it's amazing. So the high gas prices could lead to a shortage of turkeys for Christmas.
I'm not particularly concerned about the turkeys for Christmas. I'm one of those people who thinks that the turkeys for Christmas is sort of a mass national delusion. Nobody actually likes it. It's imported from America. There are much nicer things to have at Christmas. We will pretend that we like this very dry meat that's impossible to cook. So that I'm not concerned about. Energy prices in general, well, I think it's very difficult to look at the front pages today and not be very, very worried, particularly as Libby said, it's very complicated, very complex supply chain, lots of different global and domestic factors that are leading to what is essentially going to be a cost of living crisis this autumn and winter. Later this week, we've got a vote on or more political debate on the £20 cut to universal credit. We're going to see the very poorest families see their income cut and their energy bills spike at just in time for Tory party conference, which I think is quite interesting. On the technology front, I do remember 5 or 6 years ago reading about a form of carbon capture that sucked carbon out of the air and turned it into sort of pellets of plastic that could then be reused to make any kind of plastic product. So similar to what Libby was talking about. And I also remember reading about microbes that would eat plastic and sort of biodegrade it at a much higher rate than anything currently does. These are the scientific innovations, I completely agree, that I want to be hearing more about. What happened in those 5 years? Where are our plastic eating microbes? Where is our sucking carbon out of the air technology? I mean, I guess that's also trees, but you know, maybe there's a faster way of doing it. Yes, please, if you're a scientist working on these things, please write in.
Yeah, any advice on this? Because it does seem weird that we're complaining about a shortage of carbon dioxide when that seems to be the thing that we spend most of the time being worried about. I mean, if it isn't the pollution of the air, Libby, it's light pollution that you've written about in your column today. Do you see how it's a seamless segue?
Immaculate, yes. Alan Partridge also rules. No, it was a remark by Lord Deben implying that there are many people working from home now looking for country homes should not demand street lighting but should accept that sometimes in a village you shouldn't be out after dark without a hand torch. And I think the proliferation of too much lighting, too much street lighting, often rather badly designed street lighting, is a very sad thing because our eyes adapt naturally and instantly, and we then cannot see the stars on a clear night. And there is nothing more magical, more of a sort of a heritage from our, you know, from millennia of our ancestors than the ability to look up at stars. So I just wanted to boost up the old Campaign for Dark Skies and the Parliamentary Dark Skies Group and the British Astronomical Association, all these people who talk about this and should be listened to. You know, it's a very precious thing. And my greatest treat is getting back about 1 o'clock in the morning from some theatre trip or whatever and standing outside my house and just looking up at this shining sky, because it's pitch, pitch dark here. It's magical. And more people should have a chance to visit places like that and see that sight.
I sort of totally agree with you. And I quite often go out with my app. I can't remember what it's called. It might just be called Night Sky. You can sort of hold it and it'll tell you what all of the stars are that you can see. So I think, did you see Jupiter last week, if I made that up? I think you could see Jupiter. It was quite near the moon last week. So it's a really nice thing to be able to do. I suppose the counter-argument, Libby, is that lots of people would say, well, actually, street lights make streets safer if people are out and about on their own at night.
Maybe in the cities, yes, but, you know, it's not that much. I mean, the thing which really annoys me is people who are in remote country places and who are so frightened of everything that they put up these Rottweiler lights, you know, these motion-sensitive, very, very bright anti-burglar lights. And actually, those are brilliant for burglars, apparently. I have been told by an actual ex-burglar that you can kind of creep up. A, they light up all the bit things you might trip over, and B, you can creep up the dark bit at the edge of the light. It's much easier to hide when there's a bright light shining in people's eyes. So I think, you know, it has to be balanced. You know, public safety and general safety and so on has to be balanced against common sense here. And I'm all for the torches in the country villages, certainly.
That is proper journalism, isn't it? Interviewing an actual burglar about burglar lights. That's wonderful.
I'm afraid I have to tell you, Rachel, that as you go on in your life through journalism, there's always an ex-burglar or two looking to be on the radio. They're not hard to find. It's like ex-addicts, you know, you can't shut them up.
Go on then, Rachel, what do you think about this? Should we turn off all the streetlights?
Well, I'm a city girl, so I don't really know what the sky looks like in normal times. I think more street lighting available in cities, certainly in around tube stations and late at night. That's very important to make people, particularly women, feel safe and in fact be safe when they're walking home. But I guess in the countryside, if you want to go live in the countryside, you are embracing nature and remoteness and being a half hour drive from the nearest place you can get a pint of milk, which I have never understood. But if you sign up for that lifestyle, then that's what comes with it. I don't quite share your romanticism about the night sky. I like to be able to see where I'm going. But I did get a chance to see the Northern Lights in Iceland a few years ago. And that really was truly magical. So maybe there is a wonder and a mysticism and a kind of awe-inspiring nature of stars that I am missing by having grown up in a city and wanting to be, I don't know, within 5 minutes of a 24-hour takeaway.
Well, but also part of me reading your column, Libby, part of me thought actually maybe it would do everyone good to realise that they are quite insignificant in the grand scheme of things, and just to chill out a bit.
It's absolutely perfect. You sort of look up and you think, right, well, you know, they'll still be there when I'm gone, and they don't care if I get that job. They don't care if someone's rude about me on social media. You know, hello stars. Maybe it's age. But yes, they probably are, yes. But as the British Astronomical Association says, you know, they take millions of years to reach us. And why should that light be wasted in the last millisecond because somebody's gone and put up some bright street lights in a small village? No, I think I'm all for it. I think they think they ground us. The stars, ironically, ground us.
And actually, some of the most fun I've had since I've been on Times Radio was when I went out very early one morning to shoot a laser at Mars with a man from Farnham. And we had to go to like a park or a field, which was nice, and you know, so we could. And he was pointing out everything. I could see Mars, you know, literally see Mars with the naked eye. And then he was shooting his lasers at it to try and lay claim to Mars, which is a sort of separate point. But actually, being out in the early morning when it was, you know, pitch black, with somebody who knew what they were talking about, pointing everything out, is amazing. It's amazing that you could do that. And yet, more people should be able to do it. So just. Yeah, like you said, Libby, keep a torch by the front door. That's all you need. That's all you need. Rachel, let's talk about France.
Yes, war with.
Should we... It feels like France is laying a series of traps for Boris Johnson. They're just waiting for him to tumble into them all. So, obviously, there was this AUKUS deal that was done last week between Australia, Britain and America... to where Britain and America were going to share technology to build some nuclear submarines for Australia, which meant them pulling out with a deal with France. France recalled... Probably is a saga, isn't it? France recalled the ambassadors of Britain... of Australia and America, but not Britain. Basically trying to make out that Britain's now so insignificant in all of this, it doesn't need to even bother doing that. And now the French Armed Forces Minister, Florence Parly, has cancelled a meeting with her British counterpart again today to sort of, demonstrate their growing anger. What should we do about France, Rachel?
Well, I mean, we should stop relying on them to police the channel and getting upset when they're not following our instructions, which was, I think, last week's War with France story, Priti Patel threatening to withdraw the funding there. I think France's beef with the UK is unwarranted. Here, it's Australia and the US that they should be upset with. It's not our fault that Australia and the US prefer us. Sorry, I sound like a character from Mean Girls now, don't I? It's not my fault we're popular. but I think really this is a question for France and Germany and Europe and the rest of the EU about attitudes to China and why it is that the US and Australia thought that Britain perhaps would be a stronger ally on this particular issue than on a country in a bloc that has traditionally been a little bit more on the fence about the actions of China. That's what it's really about. And France can throw a hissy fit if it wants to, but that's not going to change those geopolitical dynamics, is it?
What about you, Libby? What do you think we should do about France?
Well, I'm very struck by the Mean Girls theory of UK politics in France. There is that offence in it. But Rachel's perfectly right. It's not about us. You know, it is about the new attitudes in Australia and the US about China. And I think I think it will settle down. I think these spats between us and France have tended to settle down in recent, the last 100 years anyway. China is the big thing. China is the big thing we should all be looking at now and looking at with considerable care, as well as Russia.
And I suppose that there's a question of where our allies should lie. You know, America keeps, saying that France is our oldest ally. We like to think we've got the special relationship with America. You know, clearly Emmanuel Macron is looking ahead to some... the French presidential election. So stirring up all this probably doesn't do him any harm.
Say one thing about France. At least they let us in. They're still not letting us into America, are they?
No, and there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of hope that Boris Johnson might be able to sort that out.
That's something Boris is going to have to talk about soon, because it's splitting up families, it's wrecking businesses, it's causing a great deal of trouble for really no sane reason at all, this US ban on us.
Yes.
Australia's not even letting its own citizens in at the moment.
Yeah, that's true, and we are. But maybe we should have agreed that as part of the deal with the submarines. Rachel Cunliffe and Libby Purvis there, and of course you can read Libby in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, read all about it.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, let's talk political magazines. Yes, read all about it. And we really are. The UK's political magazines are booming. So what we thought we'd do today is speak to some of the editors of some of the UK's biggest, most influential political magazines to ask, how are they doing it? Why are people sticking with print? We were all supposed to be digital by now, just reading holograms or something. And what's the role they play in the political conversation and their relationship with the political parties with which they are associated? Let's speak now to Jason Cowley, Editor-in-Chief of The New Statesman. Morning, Jason.
Morning, Matt. How are you?
I'm very good. Nice to have you with us. Fraser Nelson's the Editor of The Spectator. Morning, Fraser.
Good morning.
And a newer kid on the block, Graham Stewart, is deputy editor of The Critic. Morning, Graham.
Good morning, Matt.
So first of all, let's just give your sort of sales pitch. If I was in WH Smith's browsing the magazine racks, you happened to sidle up to me, what would, obviously from a safe distance, what would be your sales pitch of why someone would pick up your magazine? What are you going to get in the Spectator, Fraser?
You're going to get a whole range of things. All life in all of its forms is there. There is politics, but not too much of it. We've got incredible book section, coverage of the arts. We do like columns, business, the works. And the funny thing is, though, if you're actually sitting in Smith's, there isn't much of a... You're either a spectator person or you're a New Statesman person. You're unlikely, I think, to go eeny-meeny between the two of them. We're not really right. I never thought we're a rival. We're not competitors. I didn't see us that way anyway. I think the newspapers are our competitors. Like, either the spectator, we're pretty big on humour. We always do, like, a cartoon on the cover every single week. We don't tend to be that serious in the ways that some other publications are. If you're into that kind of thing, there's lots of things to choose from. And The Statesman, of course, does the same mix as The Spectator, big on arts, big on books, big on current affairs, but from a more left-leaning perspective. So I guess it's whichever floats your boat.
Okay, then, Jason Cowley, then, your sales pitch, particularly because it's got a new look, the New Statesman, which is partly what prompted us to have this conversation. So you've sidled up to me in the newsagents. How do you persuade me to buy the New Statesman?
I would say if you buy the New Statesman, you'll encounter some of the world's best writers writing on the defining subjects of our time, the big subjects that are driving change in the world today. And you'll find a liberal, sceptical sensibility informs the magazine right across it, from the political coverage, the longer reads and essays, right through into the cultural criticism you'll find at the back of the book. But also, you know, the New Statesman isn't just a print magazine. It's very much a thriving digital title today. And for me, that's the key. It's both combination of print and digital, and how the New Statesman is looking to push out from its traditional niche. I mean, Fraser spoke about a left of centre sensibility. It's certainly of the left, but I would say today it has a more liberal, sceptical sensibility than being sort of party political or particularly partisan. And above all else, we're interested in good writing by unpredictable and interesting thinkers. And, you know, we think there's wit in the magazine, there's elegance, there's confrontation, but above all else, there's intelligence.
We'll come back. We'll unpick some of that in just a moment. Graham Stewart, explain to people who don't know what The Critic is and where it sits in the spectrum and on the newsstands.
Launched in 2019, like The Spectator and like The New Statesman, we have daily online-only content, but also, unlike The Spectator and unlike The New Statesman, we're a monthly magazine, a monthly magazine of about 100 pages. We think the magazine format gives us the opportunity to also have more long-form articles where writers go in-depth on important issues. The focus is primarily current affairs, but also, as you would expect from our title, a very broad cultural sweep. All the reviews, all the up-to-date information about the cultural world as well. Foremost, I think we encourage a intelligent but sceptical approach to mainstream thinking. And our contributors should never feel that there is any editorial hand guiding them away from sensitive subjects. We are fundamentally committed to a free and independent speech, thought, and the best writing.
That's a sales pitch. That's a sales pitch. Let's get under the covers now. Fraser Nelson, how weird is it you're editing a magazine of the right, the centre right, but it used to be edited by now the Prime Minister? And I was reading the editorial of the most recent one. You're pointing out, you know, it is something you point out, that when he was editor of the magazine, he advocated a migrant amnesty, something he's now less keen on. Now he's actually Prime Minister. How describe your relationship with the Conservative Party? This is sort of the house magazine of the Conservative Party. Are you a critical friend? How much time in your week do you spend thinking about your predecessor?
I spend about as much time thinking of him as any editor would with the Prime Minister's policies. I guess the difference for us is that we compare what he's doing with what he was saying and writing when he was working for The Spectator. Boris Johnson's unusual in that he's got this massive oeuvre of columns where he set out his view. And I'm a bit more supportive of him than most others. And I would say there was a coherence in what he wrote. He fundamentally was a liberal. And when he was editor, he was a hugely successful editor of The Spectator. It took us years to get back to the kind of sales peak that Boris left in 2006. And for many years, it was my ambition to get up there to where he'd taken it. But when he does something which is the polar opposite to what he was arguing for, then we point it out. For example, when he was calling for vaccine passports, we ran a page in the magazine listing all the many times he'd written in The Spectator about the need to avoid identity cards and what a threat to liberty they were. So if you like, we don't shy away from pointing out what he was doing and saying. Because you know, it's really easy for us journalists to say, oh, we think the government should be doing X, Y, and Z. But when that journalist actually gets in the hot seat, you get the chance to implement your vision. You know, huge personal power. What's stopping him now? He's got this cabinet, which is more like a court than a government. So we do tend to compare his actions to his words when he was working for us.
And how does he respond to that? Like his old workplace sticking the boot in sometimes, or sometimes just embarrassing him. Does he react?
Yes, he's very relaxed about it. I mean, I do see him now and again, and he always says, oh, that's absolutely fine. It's your, you know, he's very relaxed, almost encouraging of journalists criticising the government. He works that was his stock and trade for many years, so he doesn't take anything personally. We've never had any sort of complaints from him that we think, you know, that we've done this or that unfairly. But then again, we wouldn't expect to either, because he knows that there is a proper kind of separation of powers, as it were. You shouldn't get prime ministers really complaining about what journalists do.
And you've been editor for a few years now, Fraser. How do you find that process? And what would you say has been the best thing you've published, and what's been the thing that you perhaps regret publishing?
Oh, regrets, there's far too few to mention. The job has changed completely. I've been editor for 12 years now, and Jason also, he's been hugely successful at The Statesman. Both of us are unusual in that we've lasted more than a decade in the editor's chair. And what's changed then is the nature of a political magazine. Because right now, sure, we sell a weekly print, but the big difference is now we're doing podcasts, we're doing videos, we're publishing every day online. You're getting this extension of The Spectator, The Statesman, The Critic. All of us are becoming more daily publications than we are weekly ones. So we stand far more comparison to the daily newspaper. Some people will only have a New Statesman subscription. They will get their news from a New Statesman, and they'll be very well served as a result. That would never happen before. The same is true for The Spectator, The Critic less so because it's monthly. But what we're seeing now is I once looked at all the current affairs titles in Europe, and there are something like 70 magazines, of whom only 5 have grown in the last 10 years. And The New Statesman and The Spectator are numbers 1 and 2.
So why do you think that is? Is it because politics has been, you know, not radicalised us too much, but everyone's, you know, the interest in ideas and debate, you know, partly by maybe coalition, Brexit, referenda, Boris Johnson, Donald Trump. Is it politics is now a sort of, that's people's hobby now, in the same way they might have bought, I don't know, train magazines or whatever before?
It's certainly true that we've had explosive politics in this country ever since the Scottish referendum. That was about 7 years ago, and that was the first time things got properly crazy. Then you get the knife edge, Miliband's Cameron election, then you get Brexit, then you get COVID. So there's been an explosion in current affairs recently that has absolutely benefited news magazines. And there's so many ways of getting it. And also, things have been tough for newspapers simply because of the rising cost of the industry. It's been slightly easier for newspapers that have less sort of magazines with that are slightly smaller and slightly fleet-foot to adapt. I mean, Times Radio is a fantastic example of a newspaper brand, one of those famous brands in the world, expanding to take in the whole radio station. We magazines do this in our smaller kind of way, but that's this is why it's such a great time to be in journalism right now. Technology gives you all of these opportunities. So you end up with titles as old as The Times, as The Spectator, as The New Statesman, that end up with a bigger audience than ever before, even if the newspaper market is struggling, because of what technology offers. And that's what makes it so much of a joy.
Just finally, Fraser, have you managed to overtake the sales figures that Boris Johnson managed?
We did. I was to do that. It was about 6 years ago. When he was editor, he embodied The Spectator's values, perhaps a little bit too much with his extracurricular activity. I have to say, We like to think we've done it with it in a less scandalous way, shall we say, perhaps a less more boring way. But we've also taken our sales over 100,000. They were about sort of, I think his peak was about 68,000. So we're still going strong. I like to think we're not even halfway there yet.
Very good. That's good news for the sales and probably good news for Mrs. Nelson as well. Fraser Nelson, thanks very much for joining us. Let's speak to Jason Cowley now, Editor-in-Chief at The New Statesman. Jason, I'm really taken by you're saying you're sort of slightly moved away from the idea of being the sort of the house magazine of the Labour Party. Sort of sceptical liberal is now the sort of position you take. And I'm struck that on the front page, the most recent one, it's Angela Merkel. The leader is actually... It's an endorsement of who you think if the New Statesman had a vote in the German elections, it would be for the SPD. And then you have to get quite a long way in the magazine before you get to anything about the Labour Party. And it's a big picture of Keir Starmer under the headline, "The Man Who Wasn't There." What's been the driving force behind that? Is it because what's been going on in the Labour Party in recent years has been of niche interest? Or is it just because actually the history of the New Statesman, a long-standing publication, has been at odds with what happened in the Labour Party, particularly under Jeremy Corbyn?
I think, Matt, it goes back to the beginning of my editorship, really, when the magazine had previously been owned by a Labour MP, a guy called Geoffrey Robinson, who was very close to the Brownite faction within the party. And then the magazine was bought by an independent businessman who appointed me as editor with a mission to sort of grow, change, modernise the New Statesman. And I didn't think it was interesting for a publication to be so closely connected to one political party. And I didn't think it would be of interest to me as an editor, my staff, or indeed our readers, if the focus of the New Statesman's activities was the Labour Party. Not long after I became editor, and there isn't a causal relationship here, Labour lost the 2010 general election. Gordon Brown lost. The coalition government came into power under the leadership of David Cameron, and a whole new era of British politics began. And, you know, what a well, 11 years later, the Labour Party is far from power and doesn't look like it's going to be returning to power anytime soon. It's had a catastrophic, indeed historic defeat in Scotland, from which it's unlikely to recover, and it's begun to lose in its heartlands in the Midlands and the north of England, particularly the northeast of England. So, you know, this has been a very troubling and in many ways a shattering period of decline for the Labour Party. We've tracked that, we write about it, but always with a sceptical intelligence, and we're at a remove from the party. We're not part of any faction. This week, for example, we had Keir Starmer was interviewed in the magazine, but he didn't make the cover because I don't think he said anything particularly interesting, which warranted an appearance on our cover last week.
I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? If the Labour Party was a bit more exciting, being sort of in and amongst it would be good for sales, wouldn't it? But you're right.
I think so, Matt. In 95, for example, when Geoffrey first bought the magazine and Ian Hargreaves was editor and Steve Richards was political editor. Now, Blair and Brown were beginning their transformation of the Labour Party. And I remember talking to Steve about this, the then political editor, and he said anything they wrote about a shadow cabinet member or anything that a particular shadow cabinet member said in an interview was often then splashed on the Times or the Telegraph or in the Guardian because they knew that the direction of travel was one towards power. You know, the new Labour government would form the next government and would be transformative. And therefore, there was more interest in a party that was about to take power rather than one that seems to be mired in a long, extended and bitter civil war. Until the party starts talking beyond itself to the country at large and understanding the forces in play, the forces that are driving change, not only in the UK, but in the world, I don't think it's got much chance of returning to power.
Does it? I mean, because I know the Labour Party didn't endorse any party in 2019.
In the New Statesman, not the Labour Party.
Labour. Yeah, who knows what the Labour. But yeah, the New Statesman didn't support any party, endorse any party in 2019, in part because Jeremy Corbyn thought was unfit for to serve as Prime Minister, particularly given the record on anti-Semitism. Does this free you up a bit? Does it mean you get sort of more or less grief from people in the Labour Party? You think you should be the sort of house magazine just banging the drum for Labour, regardless of what they're doing or whether or not they're saying anything interesting?
Yeah, there's always an expectation that the New Statesman should adopt certain positions or support certain factions. You know, we certainly didn't endorse the Conservative Party in 2019. What we did was lay out an argument and offer an alternative political vision for the country, which we don't think any party has come close to meeting. You know, maybe rather high-minded, rather grand, but that's what we did. But also it was an affirmation of our independence, of our scepticism, and an indication that we were travelling in a different direction. And I think that's part of the success of the New Statesman in recent years, is our unpredictability, our consistency in many ways. I mean, it wasn't just Jeremy Corbyn. We were very, very critical of the leadership of Ed Miliband, who in many ways set the party in its present direction. So it's been anyone who'd been reading the magazine for a long time, by which I mean 5 to 6, 7 years, wouldn't have been surprised by our 2019 election. And we also have, you know, larger ambitions, not only to go beyond our traditional niche as a magazine of the British left, hence our appointment of Jeremy Clifton, the economist, as our international editor. We're building a significant international team under his leadership. And I thought our coverage of the German election has been first rate. Last week's leader was just a little bit of fun, a little bit of mischief making. obviously, we've got no influence in Germany. Although, interestingly, our endorsement was picked up by the German equivalent of Tim Shipman. You know, the dominant political...
What a terrifying thought.
Yeah. I said to Jeremy Cliff, we should interview this German Tim Shipman. And he tweeted out our leader, and it got quite a bit of traction as a consequence. So that was just a little bit of fun.
Yeah, but I suppose it is also a reflection that as a magazine, you think that what's going on in German politics, the replacement of Angela Merkel and your position on it, that is just more interesting to read than the not very exciting goings on inside the Labour Party.
I mean, Merkel's coming to the end of a 16-year reign.
Which is extraordinary, yeah.
Extraordinary period. And Jeremy Cliff, who's based in Berlin, our international editor, is an expert on German politics. And, you know, as a consequence, we gave him 4,000 or 5,000 words, 6, 7 pages of the magazine to write about it. But because of the strength of our digital offering, the piece has been shared and has travelled all around the world. So that's our ambition, to use the website to internationalise our readership. And it's working. We're very encouraged so far by the rapidity of our growth. It's good. Similar to what Fraser was saying when he was on, we have been fortunate. The last 5 or 6 years have been absolutely extraordinary politically, not just in the UK with the Scottish independence referendum of 2014, the 2015 coalition government, the Brexit vote, but also Trump and that whole period in America, the rise of national populism that swept across Europe, Macronism in France. There's been so much going on. And if you take a little bit of distance from events, you know, you analyse them, you write about them with intelligence, you look behind the news, you try and explain the forces that are driving this change, I think readers want that. It's great that we still have newspapers which are moving very, very quickly, reactively to events. But we can offer a little bit of, we're a remove of events. We're offering more thoughtful commentary, analysis, essays, longer reads, long profiles. But equally, we can do something more quicker and more reactive on our website. So that combination, I think, is what is driving the revival of political and cultural magazines. And I'm delighted, Matt, by the arrival of The Critic, which I think is a very fine publication, very very intelligent. And it's a publication of the right, but I think, again, it has sceptical politics, high-quality writing, essays as well as cultural criticism, some good political commentary. So I welcome the arrival of more publications in our space. I think it's a very good time to be editing these magazines.
Well, I was going to bring Graham in there. I'm not sure I need to. Now. Graham Deputy.
I'm very happy to do Graham's PR thing.
Well, maybe Graham, you want to repay the compliment. It's interesting, though, that, isn't it, that we were sort of, you know, for so long, you know, as long as I've been a journalist and when I first trained, 20 years ago, people were predicting the death of print. And actually, Graham, you come along and you launch a print magazine, you know, a monthly magazine. Obviously, it has got a digital offer too, but it's not entirely a digital thing. Do you think this is partly because in a world where, and I do this all the time, if I'm trying to read something on an iPad or my phone, you sort of get a few paths into it, and then, oh, something's pinged there. Oh, I'll just have a look on Twitter. Oh, I'll just... Blah, blah, blah. And you get distracted. Actually, there's something about holding a print thing in your hand which can't beep at you, and you can sit and enjoy the thing from beginning to end. Is that part of the logic of launching a print product in 2019?
Very much so. And when we did launch, many fair-minded people thought we were mad. We thought we were mad ourselves, and we've surprised ourselves by our level of sanity, because we've really exceeded what we possibly thought was possible. But I think you're right. The digital aspect, Twitter, social media, readers then sharing content they've seen online, feeds through and helps the sales of the physical magazine as well. And the two are similar, but have fundamentally different aspects, particularly in terms of the longer reads. Fraser was saying earlier that we're in an age of very intense politics, and that has certainly helped the popularity of political magazines. But we were in an age of very intense politics in the 1970s and 1980s, and the Spectator and Jason will come here on the New Statesman, but the circulation of those magazines then was much smaller than it is now. We've been around for 2 years, and we've already got the print circulation that the Spectator had in the late 1970s, when it'd been around for 150 years. So that gives you a sense of how quickly we can scale up with this mixture of digital and print. But having print, I think, is very helpful in framing our magazine and giving us an identity and a seriousness and a weight, which a lot of readers appreciate.
Jason, is it because we're so bombarded with information now from news, news notifications, rolling news on TV, on our phones, on Twitter, or whatever it might be, that actually just pausing and someone who knows what they're talking about explaining what is going on and what does it mean is a way that lots of people are now trying to navigate the world. But we're not short of information. It's the analysis and the pausing and taking stock that magazines like The Statesman and The Spectator and The Critic can do.
I think that's definitely the case. And the ability to have a monthly magazine, longer pieces where you can take time at the weekend or whenever to pause, read, get away from the screen is really helpful. So just to give an example, we did a few months ago a really long profile of Mario Draghi, very influential force in Italian and European politics. But actually, there's very little in the English language that provides an in-depth into this most important figure. So, we can run pieces like that, which might not set Twitter on fire, but for our subscribers are really informative reads.
Was that Ben Judah's piece?
Yes, that's right.
That piece also did well online. It travelled. People shared that. That was a very good piece.
It did, thank you. But I think the fact we were able to do it, first of all, in the magazine helped frame the style in which it was written. And then, as you say, it did well online as well. But thanks, Jason.
But actually, Jason, just finally, it sort of slightly goes back to the Merkel piece as well. That, there's always this complaint, why are we so obsessed with American politics as opposed to European politics, which is much closer to us? In part because most of it is in French or German or Italian or whatever it might be. And actually, a really good, thoughtful piece on German politics. I read that there was a great piece in the Sunday Times magazine a couple of weeks ago, Oliver Moody did, on sort of Angela Merkel, which really sort of tried to, much like Jeremy's piece in The Statesman, really took a step back. And you actually think people who are really interested in politics do want to know about German politics too. But it's harder to come by sometimes because the world of German Twitter and German websites is much harder to navigate than the Washington Post or the New York Times, whatever it might be.
Yeah, absolutely. It obviously helps to have linguistic experts who understand the country from inside the country, as Jeremy does, or some of of our writers who are based in France and write brilliantly about France. I mean, these European countries are obviously of dominant interest to us. We go on holiday there, we have friends there, we visit these countries regularly. But for some reason, I agree, Matt, we allow American politics, particularly American cultural politics, to kind of dominate the conversation in the UK. And I think that's a mistake. And there's this kind of misunderstanding of America, and often a complacent acceptance that America is closer to Britain than it actually is. It's actually a completely different culture from the UK. And we're often much closer to our European friends, as Boris Johnson always calls them, who are much closer and with whom we've had deep historical associations. So, yeah, we want to write more about Europe as well as the US. But I think there's too much American politics on the BBC, for example, or even American news. Sadly, if a kind of gunman goes into a McDonald's and blasts 7 or 8 people in Florida, you know, terrible mass shooting, that for some reason that dominates the BBC news to the exclusion of what might be happening in France or Germany or Italy or indeed China. And we want to look out beyond America to the rest of the world, but particularly Europe.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.